Welcome back, party people, to part three of This Is Your Brain on Birth Control by Dr. Sarah E. Hill. This is the last and final part where you will have to listen to me stumble through big technical terms. So please forgive me. Again, it's been three long parts of really technical terms. But like I like to mention in every part of this series, go and get yourself this book. Highly recommend it. And I don't go over every single concept in the book, just ones that particularly interested me or I found useful. So let's get right into it. I'm Naomi Guy. I'm usually joined by my brother, Joel, but I'm doing this series alone. You are listening to Why Winona Date These Guys. So let's get right into part three, which is the final part called The Big Picture. Chapter 9, The Law of Unintended Consequences. So a lot of people just think of birth control as a way to control fertility, and they don't really think about the consequences, like the societal consequences that come with having birth control accessible to everyone. And I think that in this last part, Sarah E. Hill does a really good job of highlighting some of the things that we don't necessarily think about on a day-to-day basis, on how this affects big picture things as well as small picture things. So what the pill has done for women. If you've had the opportunity to spend any time on a college campus in the past 25 years, you've probably noticed that there aren't a whole lot of men around. This wasn't a figment of your imagination. Most college campuses in the United States have female enrollment numbers that would have shocked even the most optimistic of feminists 50 years ago. In 2017, more than 56% of college students in the U.S. campuses were women, accounting for some 2.2 million more women than being enrolled than men. And it's not just that more women are attending college than men, it's also that they're graduating at a higher rate. In 2015, 37.5% of women between the ages of 25 and 34 had a college degree, whereas for men, the number was 29.5%. This shift in educational and job performance is usually called the male-female achievement gap. The first side to the story is that women are achieving a lot more than they used to. Back in 1940, there only about 10% of women aged 26 to 28 had completed a college degree, whereas in 2017, that number was up to 35% by 35%. Women are going to college, graduating, and entering the workforce in greater numbers than they have ever have in the past. And there's a good reason to believe that the birth control pill has a lot to do with this. The birth control pill has made it possible for women to get degrees and climb the corporate ladder without having to worry about being benched during a pregnancy, allowing us to kick ass and take names in ways that weren't available to our grandmothers. Before 1970, almost no women went into careers requiring a postgraduate education. All that changed, however, precisely at the time of our nation's history when the pill became legally available to single women, so the late 1960s to the early 70s. As soon as women felt in control of their fertility and knew that they wouldn't get benched mid-education because of pregnancy, their applications to postgraduate degree programs skyrocketed. Although the surge of women in these fields was also helped by decreasing sexism in the admissions process, the biggest driver of these effects was actually the huge surge in the number of female applicants. When it's possible for women, they do. Women responded to the freedom granted to them by the pill, not by becoming more irresponsible and reckless in their lives, which is what a lot of abstinence-only types might want you to believe, but by becoming more educated and being more inclined to contribute to fields like law, medicine, science, government, and business. And even though you and I take this sort of thing for granted, hasn't always been easy for the women that dream this big. So I would say that, like, I personally take for granted the fact that I can control my fertility and have been able to control my fertility for the past, going on, how old am I this year? 8 years I've been able to control fertility. I would like to mention that this is something that I don't think about on a daily basis. I don't think about the fact that, you know, a lot more women were able to go to college and complete their college degrees and their postgraduate degrees and so on and so forth. And obviously that has been an uphill battle because this has only been available to us since the 70s. So thinking about these things and thinking even like back to when my grandmother was growing up, it's crazy to think that we have come so long in a short amount of time, but also a long period of time. So the next part of this chapter, she talks about what this has been doing to men. So we talked about just now, we talked about how women are dealing with the control of their fertility. But now we kind of go into how men are sort of how they are being affected in the same sort of way or in different ways compared to women. Unless you live under a rock or in a Mennonite community somewhere, you are probably aware that women are a powerful source of motivation for men, like hugely powerful. Many of the things that men do are ultimately, although not always consciously, motivated by the desire to impress, woo, court, and have sex with women. And even though this might sound crass or sexually myopic, mountains of data back this up. Natural selection has wired men's brains to be inspired to do things that women value. This is why in the arts, having a muse is a thing, and why Aristotle once said, if women didn't exist, all the money in the world would have no meaning. He was right. It's true. It wouldn't. Ask any man. Women are so motivating to men because they are the ones who get to dictate the conditions that need to be met for sex to occur. Women are in this privileged position because their expensive sex sells and minimum 9-month investment in pregnancy have historically made sex costlier to them than for men, which makes them choosier. But in nature, whenever you have one sex that's choosy, usually females, you'll find that the other sex, usually males, is characterized by the great lengths to which they will go to get chosen. This means the men's brain has been designed by evolution to most want to do whatever is required for them to get access to women. If women will only have sex with men who are able to tap dance and play piano, men will learn to tap dance and play the piano. If women will have sex only with men who can crochet and mix a decent Bloody Mary, the world would become flush with yarn-based handicrafts and breakfast cocktails. The most women considered a worthy partner, the more women require of a man to be considered a worthy partner, the harder they will work to be chosen. So we don't think about that a lot either. Like, this entire section of this book is something that I haven't even considered as something that the aftershocks that have come since the legalization of birth control in the United States. So moving into how this has changed the sexual landscape for men. These changes in sexual landscape didn't come without consequences, though. The desire for sex and the need to prove themselves worthy of the act have been powerful source of motivation for men. When sex is no longer difficult to get, men lose what has been the most powerful naturally occurring motivator of achievement out there. So although the pill and the freedom it allows may be responsible for the fact that women are now able to achieve more than ever before in history, it may have the opposite effect on men. And this isn't just my opinion about what might be going on. Experiments in my lab support this idea. We find that men's achievement, motivation, and self-control march in lockstep with their beliefs about women's requirements for sex. In these studies, we randomly assigned men to read one of two, fictitious, but they didn't know that, newspaper articles. One was a story about how dating and hooking up are harder than ever for men because women have gotten considerably choosier about their partners than they used to be. The other was a story about how dating and hooking up are easier than ever for men because women have gotten considerably less choosy. Afterward, participants were given tests to measure their self-control and achievement motivation. Guess which group of men did better and which group of men did worse? Men who believed that women's standards were high outperformed those who believed that women's standards were low. And it was not only men who responded this way. When we gave the same setup to women and measured their self-control and achievement motivation, there was no difference in their self-control or achievement motivation based on the article they'd read. Men's achievement motivation is tied to women's standards for sexual partners in a way that women's is not. And it isn't to say that all men take the path of less achievement when easy access to sex is on the table, but some of them do. And the growing achievement gap between men and women may be influenced in part by the number of men taking that path now that it's possible. And make no mistake about it, men are achieving less than they used to. In 1970, the majority of college students were men, 58%. But by 2000, that number dropped to 44%. Now, some of this difference is the result of women doing more, but some of it is due to men doing less. Women are also staying in college longer and more likely to graduate and enroll in graduate school than men. Men also have higher unemployment rate than women do. No matter which way you slice it, men are having their asses kicked by women when it comes to educational achievement and representation in the workplace. So, this next part that I think is extremely interesting is talking about the role that birth control has in why women aren't getting married currently. So there's been a lot of news articles coming out in the last 5 to 10 years talking about how, I wouldn't even say 10 years, I would just say the last 5 years, talking about how women are waiting longer and longer to get married. And there's a lot that goes into that. At some point later down the line, we're going to talk about fertility, not in like this series, but later down the line, we're going to be talking about in another episode about like fertility and how environmental factors affect fertility and how that also plays a role in the high infertility rate, as well as the low birth rate in the United States currently. And this isn't just affecting people in the United States. This is affecting people everywhere. This specific section is talking about why women are getting married less and less because of what we just talked about. Women are achieving more and men are achieving less. Although women generally move from the dating market to the marriage market once their educational goals have been attained, most men are in less of a hurry to do this. This is because men's psychology has been wired in such a way to desire sexual novelty for its own sake to a greater degree than women's. Men also don't have a waning fertility to worry about, making them more laissez-faire about the timing of marriage than women are. So for every woman who enters the marriage market, there are many fewer men. And when you combine this with the fact that men are also achieving less than ever before in history, it creates a situation in which women are finding that they have to cut some pretty crappy deals if they want to get married. Although women used to be able to expect to pair with a partner who was their equal, someone with at least as much education, earning potential, attractiveness, and world experience as they have themselves, this is becoming an increasingly elusive prospect for many contemporary women. An increasing number of women are finding themselves in the position of needing to be okay with being more educated, earning more, and doing more for their relationships and their partners if they want to get married. Unsurprisingly, this isn't something that most women are okay with. Having more education, a better job, and a safe and effective means of regulating our fertility means that women can now avoid relationships with men that are born out of financial necessity or accidental pregnancy. So if women don't find a relationship that suits them, they'll just opt out. As chronicled by Rebecca Traister's All the Single Ladies, this decision to remain single rather than end up in a marriage with someone they don't feel is an equal match is a choice that a growing number of women are making. For the first time in the United States and U.S. history, single women outnumber married women, and the number of adults under 34 who have never been married is up to 46%. This is a full 12 percentage points higher than it was only a decade ago. So the pill has simultaneously made it harder for women to find a long-term relationship with a partner that suits them and also increases the ease of walking away from a marriage altogether. So the next part is all speculation at this point, but it's super interesting, so I wanted to include it. There is little doubt that the pill, by changing the age at which women are marrying and having children, has played a key role in the increasing need for the use of reproductive technology in people's quests to become parents, and the need has definitely grown. The infertility treatment business has quadrupled in the past 25 years, becoming a $3.5 billion industry. And as women continue to delay their childbearing to accommodate their education, their careers, and their difficulty in finding an equal partner, this industry will continue to grow. As it goes with the pill, so it goes with IVF. But there might be even more to it than this. The pill may also increase the need for fertility services for other, more provocative reasons. The pill can have a not-so-terrific effect on women's ability to suss out genetically compatible men. In particular, the research finds that women tend to be less attuned to subtle scent-based cues of genetic compatibility than naturally cycling women are. And that was something that we talked about in one of the first parts. And the research suggests that one of the subtle scent-based cues that naturally cycling women seem much better attuned to than pill-taking counterparts is the scent of men who have compatible immune genes. Although there is some debate in the literature about the reliability of these effects, this research generally finds that naturally cycling women tend to prefer the scent of men whose immune genes are dissimilar to their own. And this is a good thing, because choosing a partner with dissimilar immune genes is believed to improve the health of offspring by increasing their immune system's ability to recognize the bad guys in the body. But pill-taking women don't seem to pick up on these scent-based cues, and when they do, it seems to lead them to choose men with non-complementary immune genes. If this is the case, pill-taking women could find it more difficult to have children. Although this is mere speculation now, research indicates that couples with similar immune genes may have more difficulty getting and staying pregnant. For example, research on couples with a history of unexplained miscarriages find higher than average levels of genetic similarity in immune genes between the mom and dad from what is observed in couples without this history. This suggests that women who aren't choosing partners with complementary immune genes may have more difficult time conceiving and maintaining pregnancies than women who are attuned to those cues and choose genetically compatible mates. This pattern is also observed in non-human primates. So the pill, in addition to the changes that it has on the timing and stability of marriages, could mean more fertility problems for modern couples. This may be happening because of the later age at which women are having children and because it may decrease women's abilities to choose genetically compatible mates. Ooh, so that's a lot. And I think that all of that, although it is just speculation at this point, is incredibly interesting. Like she mentioned in the book, there's not a lot of research about it, if any, at this point. So she does talk about some of the information, the scientific information that kind of backs up her claims, that she talked about pill-taking women don't have that ability to suss out immune compatible men. But when you are a naturally cycling woman, you do have that ability. And so I think that this could also kind of, and this is just my personal view, this could also kind of explain the increase in medical conditions that children are being born with more and more often. And that's just my point of view coming at it from, you know, just this is my hypothesis. But I think that the fact that there's been an increase in mental issues with newborns, so an increase in autism, an increase in ADHD, and so on and so forth, it could be, yes, because we're able to diagnose it on a more regular basis, but it could also be that there is, you know, a increase in people that are having children together that are immunally incompatible. I don't even know if immunally is a word, but like they aren't immune incompatible. So we're hopping into chapter 10, which is why didn't I know this already? So this is extremely interesting, and I'm just going to shoot some major facts at you and just jump right into it. Although Congress passed a law in 1994 requiring the National Institutes of Health-funded research include women in clinical trials, women are still vastly understudied compared with men. For example, although women make up roughly half the people diagnosed with HIV in any given year, women make up only 19% of the participants in clinical trials of HIV and antiretroviral drugs, and only 11% of participants in curative research. And the recent report on the state of the affairs with prescription drugs found that 8 out of 10 prescription drugs were withdrawn from the U.S. market soon after release because of women's health issues, indicating a failure to study their effects comprehensively in women. Despite the fact that women are more likely to seek medical advice for what ails them and are more likely to follow the advice that is given, until recently, women's health has been all but completely ignored by science. And the result of that is more and more often than not, women are completely in dark about their health and how their own bodies work. And their doctors don't always have all that much more about their, know much more about their female patients than the patient does. Although I don't think that it was very intentional, science works in ways that systematically discourage research on women. Women are harder to study than men, and because science is extremely competitive and demands a rapid pace of publication, when there aren't enough checks and balances in the system to ensure that women get studied, few people will study them. Research on women and the issues that are important to us have become a luxury that many researchers can't or choose not to afford. So, she goes on to explain that main reason why a lot of women don't get studied in and have there's not a lot of research on women in scientific studies is because they have to make sure that because women's hormones are changing every single day, they have the same part of the hormonal cycle for every woman that's being studied. So if every woman is, let's just say, on a 28 to 30 day cycle, 28 to 32 day cycle in the study, they need to make sure that everybody is coming in, like, let's just say 4 to 7 days after their cycle or their menstrual cycle ends, and they need to make sure that they have enough people, and they need to make sure that they have enough money to fund this. And if all these people are coming in at different times, they have their costs go up, the amount of people that they need goes up, and so on and so forth. So it's a major scheduling issue. And a lot of people don't understand that when you have these major research studies that, let's just say, go over immune systems, you don't think that that would require to have a certain, you don't need to schedule that with a woman's menstrual cycle. But a woman's body, because everything is surrounded by hormones and everything is, everything is controlled by hormones, they need to make sure that every single scientific study is based around a woman's certain time in her cycle. So that was extremely interesting to read because a lot of, let's just say, tenured teachers need to put out anywhere from 4 to 7 studies. I'm pulling that out of my butt. It's just like you need a lot of studies per year to be published in order to continue to be considered a PhD, like person with a PhD. So if you want to be tenured at a university, which a lot of PhD people with PhDs have, like they're working at a university, they're in academia, they're continuously, researching and stuff, and they don't want to spend the time to conduct these studies and move around certain schedules because it takes longer. And if it takes longer, then that means that they can't get the amount of studies that they want to out into, published. So a lot of this just has to do with the fact that a lot of people are lazy and a lot of people don't want to lose their jobs, which is completely fair. This economy sucks, but moving on, that entire situation sucks, but yeah. Uterine politics. Back in 2012, Durante did a series of studies looking at women's changing hormones over the course of ovulatory cycle influence political attitudes. To do this, she compared a political preference of women at high fertility across their cycle, when levels of estrogen are highest and conception is possible, with those women in non-fertile points in their cycle, when conception is not possible. The results of her research found that single women at high fertility skewed slightly more liberal than single women at low fertility. Partnered women at high fertility, on the other hand, skewed slightly more conservative than partnered women at low fertility. These results, which were interesting for both theoretical and practical reasons, were reported on CNN online, along with an interview with Durante about the various reasons that hormones influence behavior. So she goes on to talk about the fact that this person that put out this study got a lot of hate, and that apparently this person was the worst thing that happened since Barbie dolls and internet porn. But I think that this is extremely interesting because if you think about when certain elections happen and how hormones influence those elections. Like, that is wild to me. So, with the case of mail-in ballots, you have the opportunity to do it anytime before the election happen. I think it's like you get sent it about a month before, and then you can send in your mail-in ballot. So I feel like that would be a better option for women. But I don't think that this research is the worst thing that's happened to feminism since Barbie dolls and internet porn. Like, if this is research that is backed up and, has good intentions behind it to give more, know about the female body, I'm all for it. I definitely think that it's interesting that some women would tend to skew more conservative than not, even if they definitely are on the bluer end of the scale. That just fascinates me. So talks a little bit about how, there's a huge politicalization of women's bodies, and we've definitely seen that in the last couple of years. So I'm not going to bore you with more information about that. But I would like to move into how a lot of women blame their issues with their birth control on themselves and why this is not the best idea. Self-blame has been reinforced by the medical establishment, an establishment that until very recently knew almost nothing about women and how our bodies worked. In their routine dismissal or trivialization of women's concerns about the way that they feel in the pill, instead of thinking critically about the wisdom of the pill, we are taught to blame ourselves for any pain, discomfort, or sadness that we feel while we're on it. And we've been willing to do this because we feel like we don't have any other good options. This sense has created a situation in which women never think to question the wisdom of the pill, instead question the wisdom of their own bodies, thinking there must be something wrong with themselves because of their inability to handle the pill, how the pill makes them feel. So she goes on to discuss, keeping a journal and so on and so forth, which brings us right into chapter 11, which is called What Now? A Letter to My Daughter. So, there's some things that she would like you to consider before choosing the birth control that's right for you. And the reason why I kind of jumped into this after talking about the last subject was because, there's a lot of good advice about, how to deal with blaming yourself, and how to get around that. So when choosing the birth control pill, she likes to suggest that you choose what's right for you. You don't choose what's right for other people. You don't choose what's right for, you don't get the advice from other people and think, oh, this is what's going to work for me, and kind of gaslight yourself into choosing a pill that isn't right for you. So she gives some suggestions on how to best go about that, and I will mention those later. But the second tip that she says is think about your age. This is something that we haven't talked about yet, but potentially really critical because our hormones, in addition to everything else they do, also play an essential role in how our brains are put together. Up to this point, our discussion on sex hormones has focused on the types of fleeting effects that hormones have had on adult bodies when present, but that go away once the hormone is removed. These are called activational effects, and they work in a now you see it, now you don't fashion. Women go on the pill because of the activational effects of pill's hormones on the HPG axis that keep you non-pregnant. And the reason that you have to take a new pill every day is that these effects go away once the hormones are metabolized and exit the body. But hormones play a vital role in organizing how the brain and body are put together too. They are called organizational effects, and they don't go away once the hormone is removed. In this role, the hormone actually influences how the body and brain are built, which means that the effects are pretty permanent. So here are the issues of where you are in development might matter with the pill. Although research hasn't yet confirmed or denied that the pill can influence brain development when taken during adolescence or early adulthood, the brain usually isn't done developing until you're in your early to mid-20s. There is no magic number in terms of the perfect time to go on the pill and not have it affect your brain development, but I would be cautious before age 19 or 20. After 20, although the brain is still putting the final details of the frontal lobes on the frontal lobes, the benefit of pregnancy prevention may outweigh the benefits of having this process unperturbed. This is, of course, if you are sexually active. If you aren't having sex yet, I would hold off as long as you can. Although there's a decent chance it won't make a difference either way, there isn't enough research for us to know whether this is true or not. It usually is better to be safe than sorry. And if you can't be safe, not sorry at a time when you aren't having sex with anyone anyway, there won't seem to be the best way to go. There are other reasons to consider 19 or 20 as the minimum age for starting the pill. One has to do with the effects of the pill on depression and suicide risk, both of which are much higher for adolescent women, ages 15 to 19, than women 20 and older. This tells me that the self-developing adolescent brain, in addition to the fact that it is still developing, might not be well-equipped to deal with the psychological changes that seem to be initiated by the pill. We don't yet know enough about why the adolescent brain is so sensitive to these changes, and until we do, the caution is in order. This is especially true if you have a personal or family history of depression. Your mental health is too big of a deal to leave a chance. It seems like a good idea to consider alternative means of birth control if you are younger than 20 with a family history of mood disorders. No more women should lose their lives for their birth control pills, and the research suggests that taking them at the age of 20 or older is one way to significantly reduce the likelihood of an incredibly tragic outcome of suicide. Finally, consider when you are in development because the feedback loops that regulate your ovulatory cycle and your stress response are still figuring out themselves out early in a woman's reproductive career. The sensitivity of these feedback loops is something that takes time to develop, and they adapt to each woman's unique hormonal profile. If a woman's level of this hormone or that hormone is relatively low, the receptors for this or that hormone will become increasingly sensitive to them. If her levels are relatively high, on the other hand, they learn to be less so. Going on the pill when these feedback loops are still figuring themselves out might change their sensitivities in ways that affect women's ability to regulate stress and reproductive hormones. Although we know almost nothing about whether this actually happens, this is another reason to be cautious with the pill early in your reproductive career. I urge you to at least consider where you are in your development when choosing whether hormonal contraceptive is right for you. So she likes to kind of affirm the fact that you are not crazy and that you should consider your own body when making a decision on what you should do and which pill you should take and whether or not birth control is right for you. So consider these questions, and this is a list of questions that she provides. Do I feel like myself on the pill? Have my behaviors changed since going on the pill? Has my mood changed since going on the pill? Have my relationships, both sexual and non-sexual, changed since going on the pill? Has my performance at school or work changed since going on the pill? Have my interests changed since going on the pill? Have my motivations changed since going on the pill? Am I more or less motivated to do things that I used to like to do before going on it? And the big one, how do I feel about all this? Keeping a journal is, as I mentioned earlier, one of the best ways I can think of to chronicle these things for yourself. If possible, start a journal before you go on the pill. Make note of how you feel, what types of things interest you, and how your relationships are going. This will give you a trail of breadcrumbs back to yourself once you're on it. Have you changed, for better or for worse? How do you feel about the trade-offs you're making? So, like I mentioned in part two, at the end of part two of this series, I think that making sure that you have someone kind of looking after you at this time, whether it be a significant other or, your parent, somebody that knows you really well, knows your emotions, knows how you act on a day-to-day basis, knows what interests you and so on and so forth, is a really good way of keeping track of this as well as a journal. So like I mentioned, when I was on a specific form of birth control, my mother really started to see these changes a lot quicker than I did because I wasn't doing a lot of self-reflection. I had school going on. I was also a high school athlete. So I was not aware of what was going on to my body. I also was 17 at the time, so there wasn't a lot of self-awareness altogether. So she does like to mention one of the last couple tips that she says is that if you are on the pill for longer than 10 years, to take a break every so often so that you know what you're like on and off the pill. And this gives you perspective and a better understanding of if this pill is right for you. So she does give like a lot of alternative ways to, access birth control. So whether that be condoms or, a copper IUD or the birth control pill or the implant, there's so many forms of birth control out there. And, the birth control pill is not the only thing that can keep you from having children. So, I think that, being on the pill for a long period of time is like and taking breaks every so often is a great way to, come back to who you are in your cycle, as well as who you truly are at your core hormonally. And the last tip that she kind of gives is to start having these conversations with people that have uteruses around you. So make sure that, you're either handing them this book. I'm not saying that she said this, I'm saying that I would say this. I'm going to start giving this book out to everyone that I know. This is such a good book. But, having these conversations is a really powerful way to continue giving this good advice and making sure that everyone around you has the proper information. So, like I mentioned, this book is called This Is Your Brain on Birth Control: The Surprising Science of Women, Hormones, and the Law of Unintended Consequences by Dr. Sarah E. Hill. Thank you so much for coming to my first solo series on this podcast. It only took me over 2 years to do, but thank you so much. And I really, really liked this book. I think that I would give this out to everybody that I know. I'm going to start giving it out to everybody that I know that's on birth control or thinking about going on birth control. And I hope you have a great week. Thank you so much for listening.
Many thanks for the use of our theme music, which is the song Drop by Ketza. You can find more of their music online at ketza.uk. You can also find Date These Guys online on Twitter and Instagram at Date These Guys or visit datetheseguys.org. If you have questions for the podcast or want to be a wealthy sugar parent, send an email to datetheseguys@gmail.com. If you're looking to make an impact in the world, this show strongly recommends Planned Parenthood, a nonprofit organization that provides reproductive health care in the United States. Planned Parenthood provides birth control, long-acting reversible contraceptive implants, clinical breast examinations, pregnancy screenings, prenatal care, testing and treatment for sexually transmitted infections, and abortions. They also do great work for those who are lower income. Four-fifths of their clients are at or below 50% of the federal poverty line. Both Joel and Naomi are monthly donors to Planned Parenthood. We hope you will be too.